Hello and welcome to the White House. My name is Caitlin Savacek with the Office of Digital Strategy. I'm joined today by Jeff Crowley, the Director of the Office of National AIDS Policy here at the White House, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Regina Benjamin, and Dr. Carl Diefenbach, who is the Director of the Division of AIDS at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH. If you're just joining us on whitehouse.gov/live and you'd like to submit a question, click on the link to Facebook and you can submit your questions there. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Benjamin.
Good afternoon. As Surgeon General, I want to join my predecessors, beginning with Dr. C. Everett Koop, in expressing my commitment to HIV/AIDS. I want to welcome you to this video chat as we commemorate 30 years of HIV/AIDS. On June 5, 1981, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published the first account of a deadly illness that was affecting young gay men in Los Angeles. This was the first official report that would become known as the AIDS epidemic. Since then, many of us have been touched by the disease, be it a family member, a loved one, or a friend. In fact, 15 years after that first report, I received a call that my brother, my only sibling, had had a seizure that was caused by a brain mass. That brain mass turned out to be cryptococcus. He was diagnosed with HIV and died 9 months later, just a few months before the triple cocktail drug therapy became available. Today, researchers continue to make progress on finding new ways to prevent HIV and to treat people living with the virus. Thanks to the leadership of President Obama, in addition to the White House Office on National AIDS Policy and the input of thousands of scientists, healthcare providers, AIDS advocates, and people living with HIV and AIDS, we now have a comprehensive plan, a roadmap, if you will, called the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, to help us effectively target and focus our efforts. The goals of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy are, 1, to reduce the number of new HIV infections, 2, to increase the access to care and to improve health outcomes for people living with HIV and AIDS, and 3, to reduce HIV-related health disparities. The United States Department of Health and Human Services is fully committed to implementing the strategy and to meeting these goals. We share the commitment with other departments and agencies across the federal government and with our partners, which includes state and local health departments, national advocacy organizations, and HIV/AIDS service providers across the country. It will take us all working together to move forward to find even more effective responses to the HIV epidemic. We want to build on the momentum of the past 30 years. To do that, we must have frank conversations about HIV prevention, testing, and treatment. We all need to encourage our families, our friends, our neighbors to get tested for HIV, and if they're living with the virus, to get treatment. Getting your HIV test should become as routine as getting your blood pressure tested. Everyone should be tested routinely. In fact, on June 27th, we will observe the 17th annual National HIV Testing Day, which was developed by the National Association of People with AIDS in response to the growing number of HIV infections in communities of color and other at-risk groups and communities. If you need more information, and you can certainly find more information and resources at www.aids.gov, that is AIDS.gov. And now I'd like to introduce my friend and my colleague, Mr. Jeff Crowley, who is the director of the White House Office on National AIDS Policy. He's the person that's going to guide the implementation of the strategy of the Obama administration. Jeff?
Great. Thank you, Dr. Benjamin. And I think we'll actually just go right to some questions.
Great. So the first question we have, I think, is for you, Jeff. The question is, why isn't the federal government focusing on stopping the pandemic of HIV and AIDS here at home in America, across the southern states primarily, but putting a larger focus on prevention?
Well, I would say that we are. You know, President Obama is deeply committed to sharpening our response to the domestic HIV epidemic. That's why He, you know, allowed us to run this process where we worked with the community to develop a comprehensive national AIDS strategy. And a number of exciting things have happened since that time. When we released the strategy, we also made new investments in prevention through the Prevention and Public Health Fund. We just came through a very difficult budget environment for this year, but we're making new investments in HIV prevention. But we're also enacting some important new policy changes. One of the key principles of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy is that funding must follow the epidemic. So we're doing work at CDC and at Housing and Urban Development, where we have the Housing Opportunities for People with AIDS program, to adjust the funding formula to make sure that we're funding programs based on where we have the most people living with HIV. But there's also a number of exciting policy activities taking place, and we're also trying to take advantage of new research results to really ensure not only that we're investing in HIV prevention, but we're focusing on the interventions that are most likely to reduce transmission.
Great, thank you very much. The next question I think is for Dr. Benjamin, and this one comes from David. And he asks, what role does the sharing of personal stories play in helping to inspire people to end AIDS once and for all? Can you share with us a personal story about your own AIDS hero?
Well, actually, I told you about my brother and my only sibling. It's very important that we start to talk about it and share those stories, because there's such a stigma, and to have those conversations within the community, within your family, is so important. And also understanding that other people are going through the same things that you are sometimes make it much easier. 30 years ago, it would have been very difficult to have that kind of conversation. Today, we want to make sure that everyone talks about it and takes away some of that stigma, and also will help you find people who are in your community who may need help. You can help them just by listening. But I think those personal stories are very important.
Great, thank you very much. The next question is for Dr. Diefenbach, and this one is from Aurelian. And he asks, as the number of long-term survivors is growing, there are several unexpected health complications and comorbidities that are starting to appear. Are there efforts underway to increase the research funding for the subject of HIV and aging?
That's a very important question. And this is an important problem in the United States. But if you think about the global community who have just initiated antiviral treatment, this is going to become a global problem as well. So from a research perspective, this is a very important area. Because it affects virtually every organ system in the body, it really needs to maintain a multidisciplinary approach to this question. So first is to figure out what is the driver, the mechanism behind this premature aging syndrome, and at the same time simultaneously try to develop therapies or additional treatments to help mitigate these consequences. One of the key areas that may actually help a lot is starting HIV therapy earlier. And as such, we have studies ongoing now to look and see specifically if initiating therapy as early as possible, say at a CD4 count at 500 CD4 cells or greater, will have an impact on this premature aging syndrome.
Great, thank you very much. This is another question that just came in on Facebook, and I think, Jeff, this might be a good one for you. The question is from Sharon, and she asks, as part of the National HIV and AIDS Strategy, addressing disparities is an important goal. Can you share with us some of the concrete steps that you plan on taking specifically with regards to preventing HIV among young people and people of color?
Certainly. Well, one of the things that when we released this strategy, the president directed lead federal agencies to develop their own detailed operational plans for implementing the strategy. And one of the things that the Department of Health and Human Services did, which we know has a disproportionate responsibility for implementing the strategy, is they, for the first time, asked the individual agencies like the NIH, the CDC, and all the agencies that do HIV work to show how they're allocating their funding, to look at which populations, to see if there's a good match between the populations at greatest risk and the populations that are receiving resources. So this is an important tool that we can track to make sure the money's following the epidemic. But also, you know, we've never had better tools to prevent HIV, and so there's a real focus about identifying those strategies that work, testing, getting people into care, but really targeting our attention on the populations at greatest risk. Again, people of color, gay and bisexual men, some groups of young people are at very high risk, so really focusing there. But there's also some exciting new surveillance tools, and one of these is this concept of community viral load, and I won't explain it now, but it's a tool that scientists can use to really track where HIV and infections are happening in a community and find out if we're effectively getting people with HIV on therapy. And it's a tool that we think can help us really address some of these disparities.
Great, thank you. Next question, I think, is probably for Dr. Diefenbach. This comes from Barbara. Are we ever going to find a cure for HIV and AIDS? I think there's a couple questions that have come in on the same topic. Another one from Josh said, where do you think HIV and AIDS research will be in 5 years or in 10 years? Will there ever be a cure?
That's a really interesting question. So at the time of going back in the history of AIDS, there was a sense of optimism with the discovery of the triple combination that maybe we could achieve a cure within a very short period of time. What we discovered was actually the virus persists in the body in many ways like a tumor, in that it is always present. There's a problem in cancer called minimum residual disease. What we need to be able to do is figure out how to target those cells, either by immune methods or by directly targeting and killing those cells. I think there will be a cure someday. The NIH is committed to, is actually making significant investment in this area now, because there has actually been a case of an individual who has been cured. He's referred to as the Berlin 2 patient. The process that he underwent is atypical and could not be applied to others. But because he went through this procedure so successfully, it provides a little bit of a roadmap for how a cure could be achieved. So with that kind of a roadmap and a proof of principle, we feel a cure is within our grasp. Maybe within 5 years. I'm an optimist.
Great, thank you. The next question I think is probably good for Dr. Benjamin. And this person asks, how many people have been infected with AIDS since it was discovered 30 years ago?
You know, there's since 1981, when the first case was done, there's been about 25 million people that's been infected by, or 25 million people who died from AIDS. There's been 60 million people who've been infected by it. We estimate that about 2.5 million new people get infected every year, and that about 2 million will die each year. So the numbers are big, but it's also important to know that those are worldwide numbers.
Okay. Got another question coming in. It's probably a good one for Jeff. Where does President Barack Obama stand on funding for AIDS AIDS treatment and programs by the government? And what is he planning to do in the future to help the fight against AIDS?
Sure. Well, you know, as I said, the first thing that he's done is he developed a national AIDS strategy, and I think that's important. That we know our country is facing very difficult challenges right now, so we need to be ensured that that we can go to the American people and tell them every dollar we invest is going to be targeted and it's going to have the biggest impact. So he's done that, but you know, we just came through a difficult budget challenges, and we've had to make tough choices in our federal budget for FY11. But in that context, we've also managed to do reasonably well. So I believe the NIH research budget had a slight increase, and so that should translate to good news and hopefully a slight increase in AIDS research funding at NIH. At the Health Resources and Services Administration, which runs the Ryan-wide HIV/AIDS program, a big challenge right now is funding for AIDS medications through the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. There have been a growing challenge of waiting lists in about 11 states. So people with HIV that need HIV medications told they have to wait. It's something that President Obama has made a clear priority. Last year, when this crisis first developed, Secretary Sebelius transferred $25 million through an emergency action to shore up the program. The budget that was enacted for FY11, we fought for and had some bipartisan support for increasing the funding by $50 million from the funding level for at the beginning of FY2010. So we now spend $885 million this year for AIDS drugs, which is a really strong sign of commitment from the American people for HIV/AIDS programs.
Great, thank you. Another question that came in over Facebook, Justice put me another good one for you. And the question is about the role that we're playing sort of in the international community. What part is the United States taking in international efforts to find a cure for HIV? And is there cooperation with scientists around the globe?
Certainly. Well, Dr. Diefenbach might be able to speak about the cooperation with scientists, but as many of you may know, President Bush launched the PEPFAR program, which stands for President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. That's something that President Obama believes is very important. In fact, in this administration, we launched the Global Health Initiative, which seeks to build on and really institutionalize the important advances that we've seen globally. So prior to this initiative, there's a belief that we could never afford to get drugs to people in Africa and other places, that people wouldn't be able to get access to them, we wouldn't be able to take them. And now we're seeing, just as we've seen in the United States earlier, we've seen dramatic declines in HIV mortality around the world. The United States is a major funder of that, funding, I believe, about 58% of funding by governments globally. So we're a major leader, and we're literally saving the lives of millions of people with HIV around the world. Now, as we've done this work, there's a number of initiatives, but one of the recent things that the PEPFAR program has done is really look at how can we make this program more sustainable. So there's a new initiative to invest in medical education, both at medical schools in Africa and training nurses around the continent. And that's just one example I can think of. But again, Dr. Diefenbach, are there other collaborations that you would like to point to?
I think one of the more interesting collaborations has actually been organized by the International AIDS Society, which is one of the key groups that help sort of galvanize the global fight against HIV/AIDS. They have a program to bring the scientists from around the world that are working on the cure together to create sort of a critical mass of, and where the best ideas can come forward, whether they're from the United States or from South Africa or Europe. It doesn't matter. And the support can then be achieved through this consortium that's being built by the International AIDS Society.
Great, thank you. This is probably another good question for Dr. Diefenbach. Marianne asks, while miraculous advances have been made in the area of treatment, very little has happened in the area of prevention. How will the current administration prioritize prevention, especially among the most at-risk preventions or at-risk populations?
Well, thank you for that question. Actually, I beg to differ with the questioner. We have made tremendous strides just within the past 2 years on the research side for prevention. We've had a breakthrough on HIV vaccines. We've had the release of the information about topical microbicides being effective in women. We've had the use of Truvada as pre-exposure prophylaxis in men who have sex with men. And then just recently, the discordant couple study, HPTN-052, that showed we could achieve a 96% reduction in transmission among discordant couples when the partner was taking medication. So we've had significant success on prevention. Additionally, coming back to the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, the first goal is reduction in the number of infections. So the administration, the research community are strongly behind HIV prevention. It's now a matter of rolling out these tools. That is the next big challenge we face.
Great.
If I could just jump in, and Dr. Diefenbach, I know, agrees with that. One of the big challenges, too, is that we have a lot of good tools for prevention. So where we're at now is trying to figure out how to combine them most effectively. And those combinations might be different for a different population. So again, we have access to treatment, we have HIV testing, we have education, we have a variety of things. And it's how do we put the pieces together to have synergistic results for everybody.
It comes back to knowing your epidemic. In each epidemic, in each population, will have a unique set of tools. And that's why what Jeff is saying is so critical.
And I would just remind you, it takes all of us to work together, not just the scientists and the policymakers, but those of us at home, those of us in our school systems, in our industry. It will take all of us to pull all of this together to someday, 30 years from now, to say HIV is eradicated.
Great, thank you. Next question I think is a good one for Dr. Benjamin, and this comes from Tanya from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And she says, I have 5 children, and I was wondering, is there any way of helping my little ones understand more about AIDS in a kid-friendly way?
You know, it really is important that you talk to your children, and kids want to learn from their parents and have those conversations because they will be hearing about this in schools. They may have kids in their school who may be infected. You know, we saw that with Ryan White and others like it. Kids I've gotten an opportunity to meet who were HIV infected, who go on to live wonderful lives. Your kids want to talk to you about it. So rather than send you to a specific website, I'd say search for how to talk to your child about HIV. And if you do that search, a number of programs will come up, particularly with a number of the organizations and the support organizations and national organizations have services and things available. And we also have the www.aids.gov that you can go to, put your zip code in, and get more resources and information. But it is important that you talk to your kids. And you don't have to talk about how it's transmitted. You can wait until they're a little bit older, but talk to them about the fact that it is a disease.
Great, thank you. The next question came in from Facebook from Hannah Green. This might be a good one for you, Jeff. And she asks, what's the current state of federal support for the role of mental health and substance abuse in HIV prevention and treatment?
Well, you know, we have overlapping epidemics of HIV and mental health, HIV and substance abuse. And, you know, when we developed the strategy, SAMHSA played a critical role in this. And so CMS that runs Medicaid and Medicare. And we're continually trying to look at ways that we can better integrate our programs. Housing and Urban Development was involved, and there's a role for them to integrate programs with that work with substance users and others. One of the things that is potentially exciting or will be a new tool is when the Affordable Care Act is implemented. As we have more people that have access to insurance coverage, that could help us make gains. But also as more people have access to mental health treatment and substance abuse treatment, that also I think will help us with both our prevention goals, but also better treat people living with HIV who have co-occurring conditions.
Great. There's actually a follow-up question from William that sort of relates to the administration's efforts to fight HIV and AIDS and the Affordable Care Act. And he asks, one thing I never heard anyone talk about, including the president, is how HIV-positive people will be covered under his new health care plan. Is HIV considered to be a pre-existing condition, so coverage is guaranteed?
Well, certainly. I do believe that the Affordable Care Act is perhaps one of the most critically important pieces of legislation ever for responding to the HIV epidemic. There's different ways that people will gain coverage. A lot of people with HIV that are currently uninsured, we think, will gain access to Medicaid, because that'll be expanded in all states up to 133% of the poverty level. But also for working people and other higher income people above that, they'll for the first time have a guaranteed right to go out and purchase from competing options in these private insurance exchanges, where they'll have choices and they can pick from. We will be, the law will be prohibit discrimination on the basis of pre-existing conditions, including HIV. So unlike in the past, people won't be denied insurance coverage because they have HIV. There's also a number of other critical protections. The law eliminates lifetime caps on insurance benefits. It phases out and will gradually get rid of annual limits, which have been problematic for people with HIV as well.
Great. So we have another question coming from Facebook. This one's from Charles. It relates to PEPFAR and also our domestic spending on HIV and AIDS. The United States is currently spending nearly $7 million on PEPFAR, and yet our domestic care and prevention programs are in crisis. What will the White House do to preserve domestic access to services?
Well, the American people have broadly supported a strong domestic response to the HIV epidemic. We will spend in this year more than $21 billion responding to the domestic HIV epidemic. About half of that is care and treatment. That's grown every year. As I previously mentioned, the president's made funding HIV programs a priority. He's fought for it. That's in the last budget round. Again, we saw increases in the ADEP program. We saw increases in HIV prevention at CDC. We saw increases at NIH. But then the entitlement programs, Medicaid and Medicare, also have an important role to play as well.
Great. So this is probably a good question for Dr. Diefenbach. Constance actually directed this right to you. She said, Dr. Carl Diefenbach recently commented on the TLC Plus approach, and I would like to know how this approach will be aimed to reach minorities, young adults, and teenagers, along with those with disabilities.
So I think that's an excellent question. I think the key first step for getting successful testing, linkage to care, and treatment, followed by adherence to antivirals, is being able to effectively start with effective testing. And so as we work with the CDC and we work with the other parts of HHS and health departments around the country, how can we effectively get the message out that testing is essentially the fifth vital sign? As Dr. Benjamin reminded us, it should be as easy to get an HIV test as to get your blood pressure taken. Additionally, for high-risk populations, in some ways it would be great to follow the San Francisco model, where the group at the head of public health in San Francisco would like to see testing for those populations twice a year, not once, but twice a year, so we can identify people as soon as they're infected and get them into testing and linkage to care. Second, it is not sufficient just to test. Testing must be accompanied by an effective means of linkage, and that means co-locating your testing facility with your care facility, that's ideal. You can't just hand somebody a slip of paper with a phone number on it and expect them to respond. But all of this must be delivered in a culturally sensitive, culturally competent way, so that the people who are receiving the relatively devastating diagnosis of an HIV infection feel they're being cared for and taken care of. And only through those kinds of integrated approaches will we be successful with TLC+.
Great, thank you very much. So this question comes from Sven, and I think it's a good one probably for you, Jeff. His question is, with the suffering that has been endured by the LGBT community, a community that was decimated by AIDS and ignored for so long, when will the federal government finally sort of treat us as equal human beings in all aspects of the law?
Great. Well, you know, one of the important aspects of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy was its focus on gay and bisexual men. Gay and bisexual men, our best estimates are there, they represent 4% of adults and 2% of all Americans, yet they're responsible for 57% of new infections. And that's they've been disproportionately a part of the epidemic since the beginning, but we're not sure we've ever sort of foursquarely, you know, told the American people that they're at such great risk. The strategy says in bold that we'll never be able to get our HIV epidemic under control in the United States unless we have a renewed focus on responding to gay and bisexual men. So we've taken a number of steps. I mentioned that HHS is looking at how we allocate funding to make sure that we focus on populations at greatest risk. CDC is doing a number of things that are really important. They're making new investments in surveillance. You know, 2% of the population, a pretty small population, so they're doing new work to help us understand what the epidemic looks like, where it is, so we can target resources effectively. But they also are trying to do new work to put HIV prevention in a broader context, so that we're helping gay and bisexual men live healthy lives, and HIV prevention is one part of it, instead of just telling people, don't do something, you know. And so integrate the much more positive messages that are easier to sustain over a lifetime. But you know, this is also exists in a much broader context, that the administration has been very active supporting the LGBT community. We eliminated the HIV entry ban. You know, of course, the president, you know, signed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. But he also issued a presidential memorandum that allows for same-sex partners to visit their loved ones in hospital settings. So there's a number of things that we've done, and our focus on gay and bisexual men as far as preventing HIV is just one part of a broader story.
Great, thank you. So this question just came in on Facebook. It's from Daniel Volp. It might be a good one for Dr. Diefenbach. And he says, adherence to the retroviral regimens is the largest challenge for those who are on medication and is the leading cause of drug-resistant strains. What can we do to make sure that people adhere to their drug regimens?
There are several things that we can do to help people adhere. And there's a process that is in place for dealing with chronic diseases in terms of providing peer and near-peer educators, providing assistance and coaches to help people stay adherent. At the same time, one of the best things we can do is improve the quality of the drugs. We can make the drugs so they have fewer side effects and also reduce the number of times people have to take pills. So if you have a pill that's one pill once a day with very few side effects, it becomes significantly easier to adhere. That in a nutshell is what we can do. Ultimately, the way to make it so people can adhere is to eliminate the disease. And that is why we need to continue to work for a cure.
Great, thank you. So another one that just came in from Allison Klein, and she asks, how can community health programs encourage HIV testing?
So I think that, you know, there's been a lot of work that has been done focusing on testing. So we've tried to routinize it in clinical settings. So CDC has these recommendations that all adults should be tested for HIV. We've done work with the VA. So now it's more routinely, they do routine screening. We've put out Medicaid director letters. So telling state Medicaid programs, they can get reimbursed by the federal government if they do population-based screening. But CDC has also funded a number of initiatives that support HIV testing through state and local health departments. But there's been a big focus on targeted testing to the populations at greatest risk. So gay and bisexual men, African Americans, Latino Americans, substance users. So we've really been trying to make our investments because it's not so much how many people we're testing, it's really identifying the most number of positive people. And we think it's important to do this in a number of settings. You know, new testing technologies have enabled us so it doesn't have to be, all testing doesn't have to be done in a doctor's office. So we fund a lot of outreach so people can go where the people are in communities and support testing. And certainly community health centers have a role in that.
In addition to the community health centers, many of the community organizations are very involved in this, and we've also involved the faith-based communities. Many of the churches have outreach programs to testing as well.
So. Great. So I think we have time maybe for just one more question. This one came in from Facebook from Keenan, and he asks, does President Obama plan to put HIV prevention classes in schools across the nation? This hasn't been brought up yet, and some folks are curious about education.
Yeah, well, maybe I can take that. So when President Obama came into office, you know, there was a lot of controversy about funding for absence-only education. And one of the things that the president said he believed is that he believes in evidence-based approaches. But we also believe that there's people of good faith on both sides of this divide, and we agree on far more than we disagree. So we've launched a teen pregnancy prevention initiative, and a cornerstone of that is that HHS did a comprehensive evidence-based review of which programs and models work. And generally, those are programs that put HIV prevention in school settings in a broader health context. So we've transitioned to this program where most money goes to that. We also, though, a quarter of that funding allows for experimentation. So people have new ideas that they want to test new models. They can do that. So we basically continued the same funding. We were about $110 million a year for that program. But through the Affordable Care Act, we've also, there's two new programs. There's a personal responsibility education program that was funded that does comprehensive work. And there was an absence-only program, which we didn't really support the absence-only approach, but tried to work and implement the program faithfully in a way that would be effective. So we've really, at the federal level, increased funding for school-based education. But I think we have a sounder footing on the models and programs that have been demonstrated to work most effectively. So we're trying to encourage local school districts and others to really look at which programs work and adopt those.
Great, thank you. So before I turn it over to Dr. Diefenbach for some closing remarks, I just want to remind everyone that if you're just joining us now, the full video of this chat will be available on whitehouse.gov probably tomorrow. If you want to get some more information about sort of the federal response to HIV and AIDS, be sure to visit aids.gov. So Dr. Diefenbach?
So as we started our video cast, we were reminded that June 5th marks the 30th anniversary of the publication of the MMWR reporting the first cases of Kaposi sarcoma and PCP pneumonia, which did in many ways herald the beginning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. At this 30-year mark, we can look back and realize that there's a lot that has been accomplished domestically and internationally. However, we are not finished. We have many tools today, as Jeff and Regina have reminded us. What we have to do is figure out how to effectively use these tools. And I think, personally, that we have the tools today to have a significant impact on the HIV epidemic, both domestically and internationally. Through expanded testing, through expanded treatment, we can reduce the number of new infections. Through the full implementation of the President's National HIV/AIDS Strategy, we can tackle this epidemic and reduce the number of new infections by 25% to 50% over the coming years, and also improve the health of those people who are currently infected. Internationally, we have seen a growth from 2000 to today, from about 200,000 people on treatment in the year 2000 to over 6 million people globally. As this number expands, we will see an impact on the epidemic. We need to be able to sustain and grow the number of people on treatment globally because we now know that treatment is prevention. At the same time, we cannot lose sight of the need for new innovations. We need to be able to innovate on the level of bringing HIV vaccines forward, evaluate them, and when effective, implement. We need to be able to implement PrEP and microbicides when proven to be effective. And at the end of the day, have comprehensive prevention strategies that work for specific communities. By working together, all of us, we can begin to eliminate the epidemic. And through this work, plus working towards a cure, someday we can celebrate World AIDS Day. We can celebrate June 5th, not as a marker of an anniversary of AIDS, but knowing that there are generations now being born that will never know the scourge of this disease.
Thank you very much.